This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Guest today on Keeping the Faith is Christopher Mitchell, a professor at Wheaton College in Illinois. We're going to be talking about C.S. Lewis, one of the most popular authors of the last century and of today. And I'm happy to say that we do have Professor Mitchell on the phone. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And you're speaking to us from the Wade Center, the Marion Wade Center in Wheaton, Illinois. And tell us, how did the Wade Center begin, and how did you get all these materials from C.S. Lewis?
It began with Professor Clyde Kilby, who was part of the English department here, who was teaching in the late 40s and 50s on not only Lewis, but Dorothy Sayers, G.K. Chesterton, George MacDonald. And his interest grew. He met Lewis on one occasion, began to correspond with him. And when Lewis died in 1963, Dr. Kilby made the first of about nine trips over to England, and that was the summer of 64, with the idea of exploring the possibility of collecting Lewis's papers along with some other British authors. And when he returned that summer, he was convinced that there was a good chance he could do this, and so he made a proposal to the library, and it was accepted, and in 1965, the C.S. Lewis collection was established. Now, at the time, there were seven authors, not just Lewis, but Owen Barfield and Dorothy Sayers and J.R.R. Tolkien, Charles Williams, G.K. Chesterton, and George MacDonald. There were seven of them. Lewis was sort of the center, and then in 1974, friends and family members of Marion E. Wade, who was the founder of the Servicemaster Corporation, established an endowment to help the collection continue to develop, and that was 1974, and the name was changed at that time to the Marion E. Wade Center.
Now, you've been director how long?
17 years.
And your background is in Christian theology. You have a PhD from St. Andrews University in Scotland in theology. How did you get involved in being interested in these authors, and particularly C.S. Lewis?
My reading of Lewis early was just more helpful and then, you know, casual. But when Lyle Dorset stepped down as director, he was the second director here.
After Clyde Kilby.
After Clyde Kilby, and that was 1980, they began a search for a new director. 1990. And by 1993, I was in the theology department here. And eventually, I was approached, and through a process of, you know, thinking, praying, I ended up moving from there to here in 1994 and took up the directorship with the idea of growing in my understanding of the way this collection works and of the authors. And, of course, Lewis is one of the central figures here, so he was one of the first ones I had to tackle, as it were.
Well, let's jump right into what this very fascinating collection is here in the state of Illinois. And Wheaton is a western suburb of Chicago. And how many visitors do you have a year?
I can anywhere now from 8,000 up to 10,000. And we have about now, I think it's close to 1,000 a year using the reading room. And the collection, as I said, is seven authors, and we not only focus on their books and papers, manuscript material, but all secondary sources as well, so as periodicals, oral history interviews, MA and doctoral theses. So we have about 50,000 pages of just correspondence alone of our authors.
Say that again. How many?
About over 50,000 pages of correspondence. Now, that doesn't include the manuscript material.
So these are letters to and from these authors?
Mostly from.
From these authors.
Like their letters. We have now, again, my archivist would be able to tell you exactly, but we're looking at close to 2,500 letters of Lewis.
Wow.
We have the largest collection of letters. We also have, Dr. Kilby got to know C.S. Lewis's brother, Warren Lewis, and that relationship developed to where when Warren died in 1973, he willed all the C.S. Lewis family papers to the Wade Center. And in that came a lot of the childhood stories that they wrote called Boxin'. Along with it came 11 volumes of family papers that Warren put together. We also have
all of his diaries, right? All of
we have Warren's diary.
Yes.
And we also have over 2,300 volumes of Lewis's personal library. At least half show his use, and there were a number of them with marginal notations that he put in.
Let me interrupt just a moment to explain that. Usually my listeners know that I know very little about the subject of I'm talking about here. I just ask a lot of questions, but it does happen that I have studied Lewis in the past, and in fact, my PhD dissertation at Duke was on the theology and the fantasy novels of C.S. Lewis, and before that I was a student at Wheaton College and graduated in 1965 and had taken courses with Clyde Kilby. When I was an undergraduate. In fact, I took one course on C.S. Lewis and his writings from Kilby. So if I seem to be somehow knowing a little bit of what I'm talking about today, I know that's unusual, but that's why. I do want to encourage listeners, however, to take advantage of the fact that we are talking with one of the foremost scholars on not only C.S. Lewis, but these other authors. And today we're focusing on Lewis, but if listeners have a question, this is a live call-in show, and I encourage you to join in this conversation. The way to do that, if it's a long-distance call from our studio here in Urbana, Illinois, at the University of Illinois, use this toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, we ask local listeners to use a local number, 333-9455. So if you're in the 217 area code in Champaign-Urbana, where it's a free call, just punch in 333-WILL, 333-9455, to be talking with our guest today, Christopher Mitchell. Chris, you and I have not met, as far as I know, but when you first came to the collection, what did you have any idea that the popularity of Lewis and his writings would continue to grow? Here we are, how many years after 1963?
Yes. No, I didn't. In fact, when I moved over here, I wasn't even aware of how popular Lewis was, even at that time. And his popularity has actually moved beyond the English-speaking world. I've done lectures in Korea and China and Kazakhstan and actually in Africa as well. The popularity does not seem to have waned at all. And I imagine part of that has to do with the clarity of both his writing and his thinking, and that he wrote on issues that really never do go out of fashion. They're just sort of recycled in our thinking because they're really the big questions, the big issues.
And his own personal story, going from being a very strong atheist while he was a student at Oxford and a professor at Oxford, and then being converted to first theism, believing there was a God in his, 30 or something, and then finally coming to the conclusion that Jesus was the Son of God. When he was 31?
About 33.
33, okay.
Mm-hmm.
That personal story continues to have a lot of appeal. People are curious about it.
Yes, and in fact, when the news first came out and he began to write and go public with his faith, which was at that time not very popular, especially in Oxford, it was news, and eventually it caught the attention of the English-speaking world here. And in 1947, he was the feature in Time magazine here in the States. Had his picture on the front cover, and he was a heretic. That's what the article says, and his heresy was Orthodox Christianity. It was just news that a well-educated Oxford don could continue to believe in a real God and a real devil. And that was news.
And his first really popular book, The Screwtape Letters, really swept the English-speaking world at the time.
Yes, it did. Again, it was so cleverly written, and that was part of it as well.
I realize we may have listeners who have never read a word of C.S. Lewis, but have maybe run across some of the movies of his Narnia series. Let me ask you a controversial question, Professor Mitchell. Would C.S. Lewis have approved of the fact that his children's stories have been turned into movies?
I don't know that he would have thought of it in that way. Once he had written something, it was published, it was in public domain, and he let it go. He didn't really hold on to things. However, he did say that one of his concerns, especially with the Narnia Chronicles being put into any kind of movie medium, is because animals were so much a part of it, he was concerned that they would come across as sort of buffoons and not very realistic. Now, what he wasn't aware of is the level of technology that we have today. So it's difficult to say what he would have thought. I think technologically he would have been pleased. I think some of the liberties that were taken with his stories, I'm not so sure he would have been pleased with. But again, one does not know because he's not around.
You mentioned he died in 63 at the age of 60. Just short of his 65th birthday, on the same day that President Kennedy was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
What about the other movies? Some of our listeners may know the movies about the relationship between C.S. Lewis and his wife, Joy Davidman, the American that he married, a former communist, also a former atheist. She became converted to Christianity partly as a result of reading some of his books and later corresponded with him, later went to England, later was divorced and married Lewis. And there have been two films made, one by the BBC and one by an American movie company, both very fine films, but they also took a bit of liberty with the stories. And one of your former directors there, I believe.
Lyle Dorset?
Yeah, Lyle Dorset, in the preface to one of his books about Joy Davidman, And God Came In, comments that he felt that the information he came up with in his research about her life got kind of distorted in a few places in those movies. Would you like to say something about that?
With regard to Joy, I can't say a whole lot. And again, there are two different ones. You have the BBC portrayal. And what I can say about that one is the portrayal by Josh Acklin of Lewis in that was far closer to the real Lewis than Anthony Hopkins in the Shadowlands movie. And this is not a judgment on their acting ability. It has to do with the way they portrayed the man. Now, Deborah Winger, who played Joy in the Attenborough Shadowlands movie, came to the Wade Center and studied here for her role. She took it quite seriously. Anthony Hopkins did not. And in talking to some people who were friends of Lewis's, particularly George Sayer, a very close friend of Lewis, he said he did not recognize his friend in Anthony Hopkins' portrayal of Lewis at all. But on the other hand, Doug Gresham, one of the two stepsons, now in the BBC, you have both boys, Douglas and David, portrayed in a Shadowlands movie by Anne Burrow. It's only the one. But Doug said that he felt that the love relationship in the Attenborough one was authentic. He felt that that was a good portrayal. As far as Joy is concerned, I mean, my understanding is that the portrayal of Joy in both of the films was closer to the real thing than necessarily, let's say, Anthony Hopkins' portrayal of Lewis. But I would defer to Lyle Dorset, who, of course, has written the book on Joy.
And again, that book is called And God Came In.
It's been republished under the name A Love Observed, and it's available still in that
title. Oh, I didn't realize
that title.
Wow.
Right.
A Love Observed, and that's a play on the book that C.S. Lewis wrote under a pseudonym after his wife died. A Grief Observed, about his sort of a diary he kept of his emotional and spiritual and intellectual state after she had died of cancer after only 3 years of marriage. They married late in his life. He was how old?
He would have been in his late 50s, middle 50s.
58 or something, and she was 45, I guess, at the time of her death.
She dies in 1960. And Lewis would have been 58 at that time.
Okay, yeah.
62, excuse me. In 1960, he would have been 60. He was born in November 1898. So 61 going on 62.
Tell us about some of the tourist attractions there at the Wade Center and who may come and see them.
Yeah, we're open 9 to 4 public hours, Monday through Friday. And typically we're open 9 to 12 on Saturday, though a person wanting to come up, I would just encourage them to look on our website. There are occasions in which we're not open on a Saturday, and over certain holidays we would not be open. But there's no charge, and free to come in. We have a museum that's very educational. We have also some furnishings. We have the desk that Tolkien wrote The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings on. We have Lewis's dining room. We have a desk and chair. And we have the wardrobe that their grandfather, Lewis and his brother Warren's grandfather, built and carved, hand-carved black oak. So it's probably 150-plus years old. When their father passed away, they were born in Belfast in Ireland. They had it shipped from there to their home at the kilns outside of Oxford, and then after Warren died, we picked it up on auction. So we have those. We have the original map of Narnia that Pauline Baynes created and painted, and a lot of other memorabilia. And then in our reading room, which is also open for not just the scholar and researcher, but for the casual reader to come in, and everything is available to look at.
Now, you can't promise that on necessarily any visit, Deborah Winger may be there too.
No, she has not been back. And very studious. As far as I know, I was not here at that time. Lyle was, and I think she spent about 3 days, worked very hard, and I think we succeeded in guarding her time, and she used it well.
And of course, she's a wonderful actress, and both movies have their fine points, and her acting is certainly one of them. But as someone who's studied a little bit of Joy Davidman's personality and character, would it be fair to say that neither movie showed her at her sort of roughest or crudest? She could be rebelled.
Yes. Yes, I think that's fair. George Sayer was honest and just said he and his wife Moira didn't like her at all.
Yeah.
And I think that was the kind of general consensus, but there were others. There was a few that did like her, and Austin and Kay Farrer, and they had a relationship. But you're right, she did not fit into especially English society very well.
But Lewis clearly loved her, and his book after her death has has really become a classic of grief.
Mm-hmm.
A grief observed. We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Professor Mitchell, Chris Mitchell from Wheaton. He's a professor of theology at Wheaton, and your chair is named after the Wade Center. Tell us your exact title. I was searching for it here in my notes, and I couldn't find your...
Oh, it's just the Marion E. Wade Chair of Christian Thought.
Professor of Christian Thought.
Right.
The Wade Professor of Christian Thought at Wheaton College. His background is theology. His Ph.D. is from St. Andrews University. Tell us how you got to theology.
I began in horticulture, mostly as a result of the influence of an old English gentleman that my mother cleaned house for, and I began to garden for. But halfway through that program, I, as a long-haired, happy little pagan in Oregon, who had never been in a church, had a faith experience. And following that, I had a big curiosity about the Bible, and so I had made a decision that I would take a year off from horticulture, try to ground myself in this new understanding of things, and then come back. But I found that my interest grew, and I really didn't want to go back to horticulture, and I just carried on from that point and really haven't looked back.
We have a caller wanting to join in with our conversation here, Chris. Let me give the numbers again for others who'd like to get in line. If you give a call, your call will be answered by our good engineer, Kyle Croa. She'll put you in the queue, as the English would say, to be talking with our guest. The numbers are 333-9455 in the 217 area code if you're in close to Champaign-Urbana. If it's long distance, 800-222-9455. And let's go to our caller on line number one. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, this is maybe kind of a humorous question to interject into a serious discussion.
No, go right ahead.
My husband and I both remember reading a story about C.S. Lewis, but when we tried to follow it up, we simply could not find it. So I'm going to tell you the story. If you haven't heard it, then I'm guessing it was a fluke of some sort.
Or apocryphal.
Yes. The story was that he was invited, this would have been somewhat later in his life, invited to address a group of clergymen in the UK about the greatest problem facing the church today. With several months lead time, of course, being a scholar, he did his research and eventually went and spoke for 45 minutes or an hour on the roof, the church roof, because he said that was what took up the most time in the vestry meetings, according to his research. Have you heard that story?
No, I haven't, and I would guess that it's apocryphal simply because I don't think Lewis was aware of what went on in vestry meetings.
I doubt if he ever attended a vestry meeting.
No, he would faithfully come to church. He had a real affection for the Lord's table, the Eucharist, but when things were over, he was gone.
Okay.
So I think I'm pretty confident in thinking that that's probably apocryphal.
Yeah, probably so.
But at the same time, I'll just say he's the kind of person who would have thought the roof was important.
Mm-hmm.
And he might well have made a joke about that then got expanded to talk 45 minutes about it. I can see how he might have said, well, you know, church members seem to think having the roof over their heads is the most important. I can hear him saying that. But
he probably would have thought the roof on the church was more important than his own roof.
Okay.
Because he didn't take care
thank
of
you.
His own
well, thank you for the question. Appreciate it. And we might just follow up with that to talk about his practical religious life. As you say, he attended worship regularly in the Church of England. His friend J.R.R. Tolkien, a good Roman Catholic, wished he had become a Catholic rather than an Anglican. But Lewis did choose the Church of England. He'd been raised in that branch in Ireland when he grew up in Northern Ireland. He didn't much like hymns. You could perhaps give the famous quote he said about third-rate music or second-rate poetry or whatever. I always get it confused.
Yeah, he was, I don't know that I could quote it either, but no, he was not fond of church music generally.
Right. But he attended regularly, and when he went from Oxford to Cambridge for the last 10 years of his life, I remember reading in Clyde Kilby's book along with, oh goodness, who was the art professor there? The photographic book of the world of C.S. Lewis, his travels and so on.
With Clyde Kilby?
Clyde Kilby and Douglas.
Gilbert, yes.
Gilbert, that's who it was, I remember reading in that they said he attended daily mass.
Mm-hmm. No, he was very faithful and took his own calling, what he thought was his own calling, very seriously. And that calling was what he called mere Christianity. I think one of the reasons he didn't go all the way to Rome, as you noted, Tolkien would have wanted him to, is that he liked the Anglican way, and he, on more than one occasion, said he was just a middle-of-the-road Anglican, neither high nor low. But he, in one place, states that there was a reason for that, that he felt that what he could offer was, again, what he called mere Christianity. And if he were to go beyond that, then he would just become one of the, what he called, controversialists, and then he would not be any good to anybody. So he felt he needed to stay basically where all Christians basically throughout the ages have been, and he felt that was extremely powerful. It's what he called the highest common factor of Christianity, and that alone was sufficient, he felt, to defend and to articulate.
We're about halfway through our program with Professor Christopher Mitchell from the Wade Center, that's WADE, in Wheaton, Illinois, part of Wheaton College, one of the western suburbs of Chicago. This program, of course, is heard in Indiana as well as Illinois. But you've heard from Professor Mitchell that the Wade Center is open for visitors 9 to 4, Monday through Friday, most Saturdays 9 to 12, but you might consult the website or give them a call. What is the website address exactly?
It is wade@wheaton.edu.
W-A-D at, and that's spelled...
W-A-D-E, it's with an E at
yeah,
the end.
Yeah, W-A-D-E, and then at, the symbol at, or the A-T?
Yes, the symbol at.
Okay, the symbol at...
Wheaton.edu. I believe that's it.
Wheaton.
I haven't used it, but I'm pretty sure that's what it is.
All right, we'll check that for you. Thank you. So, visitors are welcome. We'll be talking after this short break about how scholars may use the Wade Center with the current director who's been there quite a few years now. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Let me let listeners know who's coming up in future programs. I might say quickly that our guest who was scheduled last week got involved in a conference in Chicago and wasn't able to extricate himself in time to be on our live show last week. Our engineer, Kyle, was able to find a backup program at very short notice, and people, I hope, enjoyed that. We have rescheduled Jay Michelson to be our guest in the middle of March. March 18, we'll be talking with him by phone about his book that he talked here at the University of Illinois about at the Hillel Foundation, the Cohen Center for Jewish Life here on campus. His book called God Versus Gay? ? And we'll be talking with him about the topic we had intended to talk about last week, the religious case for gay rights. That'll be March 18 here on Keeping the Faith on WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana, and simulcast, of course, at will.illinois.edu/AM. And if you missed any of our programs or have missed part of this program and would like to hear it, you may always go to our archives at that same website. The fastest way to get there is to go to will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith, and you can leave the G off of keeping because we're just so informal here in the plains of Illinois. Coming up next week, we'll be happy to give you a little bit of a change. Maybe you'll be happy to hear this. We have someone who's going to be interviewing your two hosts for the last 13 years, Stan Yanchis, who has filled in occasionally, a retired professor from Parkland College, will be interviewing me and Don Nolan, your two regular hosts. So if you've been curious about us and what we think and believe and how we got involved in this interesting thing on the radio every week, Stan will be asking us questions, and you're invited to join in. So next week, I'll be moving to a different chair in the same studio, and Stan Yanchis will be sitting here and talking with me and Don, Professor Don Nolan, about keeping the faith. Coming up later in March, I mentioned March 11 last week, we'll be talking about church world service and world hunger, and particularly about crop walks around the world and how they raise money to help fight world hunger. That's March 11. March 18, I mentioned, was Jay Michelson. On March 25th, we'll be talking about safe zones in Kenya with Esther Portnoy and others. Professor Portnoy has spent time in Kenya, and we'll be talking about that on March 25th. April 1st, an Episcopal priest who is head of the Episcopal Peace Fellowship, Jackie Lynn, will be our guest, talking about that very interesting Anglican peace movement. Josh Slocum, April 8th, will be our guest. He's the National Executive Director of the Funeral Consumers Association that tries to make burying people affordable to even poor folks. We'll be talking about earth care on April 15 with David Sherwood and the Reverend Dr. Catherine Cusmall. On April 27th, and I wanted to get to this program particularly, we'll be replaying an archive program, an interview with Roger Ebert, the film critic from the Sun-Times in Chicago. As many know, he lost his ability to speak several years ago as a result of throat cancer. But he recorded this back in 1999, before the very first Ebert Festival of Films here at the University of Illinois. Roger's a graduate from here, of course. And he talked about religious themes in movies, and that interview had been lost for a number of years, but we found it again, and it's playable, and even though we've changed technology since 99 several times, it sounds pretty good. So we're going to replay that just on the Sunday before the Roger Ebert Film Festival happens here at the Virginia Theater in Champaign, Illinois. So those are some of the programs coming ahead here on Keeping the Faith. Well, let's get back to one other thing, I'm sorry, before we get back to our guest, Professor Mitchell. Coming up at the University Y here at the University of Illinois, as you know, the Friday Forum series are very, very long-term contribution to the university made by the University YMCA. And the creative approaches to global development is the theme for this whole semester on campus for the Friday lectures. And Reverend Axel Gehrman gave the talk last week. I got very good reports on it. I'm happy to report he's agreed to be a guest here on Keeping the Faith coming up in April, talking about Wall Street, wisdom on Wall Street. Coming at that, he spoke at Friday Forum on the 17th. And coming up next in March 2nd, Friday, March 2nd at noon at the University Y, Ashwini Chhatra, professor from the Department of Geography, will be talking about assisted development foreign aid in the new world. It's a free lecture, University Y at noon. The Y is located at Chalmers and Wright Street, available easily by bus, and there's usually parking on a Friday by noon because there are fewer and fewer classes offered on Fridays. So pretty easy to get there to hear that lecture, and of course it's free. Well, getting back to talking about the Wade Center and the collection of C.S. Lewis materials, what about scholars? How many scholars use these 2,500 letters of Lewis, for example?
Well, over the years, we're pushing 50 years old. It would be hard to say how many scholars have been through here and used and worked on the material.
No, I was asking how may scholars who are listening to this program, how may they?
All they would need to do, and even, as I say, even the casual person can come in and look, let's say, at the letters. Most all of the Lewis letters are copied, and even a transcription is provided, and they're in binders. So a visitor could come and take them down and actually read through the original letter itself in copy form. Excuse me. That would be using the reading room, and it's the rules for the reading room apply as most archives would. There'd be no bags or anything but pencils brought in, and you would sign in to the archivist at the front desk. But after that, you'd be free, once again, to use the materials. And so the procedure, it's the same for anyone who comes in, whether they're researching for a book or an article or just a visitor who would like to spend a couple hours in the reading room.
You would need to bring a picture ID.
I think they do that. You know, myself, I don't have to do that. So
you don't have to, probably, yeah.
I don't think there's any picture ID, but there is. You fill out a form, and we just have a tremendous staff, whether it's the museum or whether it's the reading room, extremely helpful, extremely knowledgeable. To be able to help you sort through, find the thing that you want.
Now, I know years ago, Chris, there were duplicates of the materials you had on Lewis at the Wade Center, also at the Bodleian Library in Oxford. Is that still the case?
Yes, we have and have for years an exchange program with them so that we have comparable collections of material on both sides of the Atlantic. Now, we don't have that agreement with the other authors, but we do with Lewis. So they have copies of the letters as well, copies as we have.
Yeah. I know back in the 70s, there was some, when I was doing my research in Oxford for a while from Duke, I got a travel scholarship, thankfully, and was able to go there. There were still some materials that were there that were not here yet, but I guess that's now
not
the case.
Yeah, it's been
now
a process.
Now they're in both places.
Right.
Okay.
And that really was completed not too long ago.
Uh-huh.
There are still, I think, a few things at the Bodleian in Oxford that we don't have, partly it's because the nature of the material is difficult to copy.
Uh-huh.
And that's the case even with some of the materials we have. We allow ourselves the judgment of whether something is beyond copying ability. It's just too fragile.
Right.
But generally, things are made available.
Now, how can you let so many people come and use the Wade Center free? Do you have an endowment?
We do. It does not cover all of our costs. In fact, it's taken a pretty good hit, as everybody else has the last number of years. And we do not receive financial support from the college. This was something that had to find its own way. And so we make our annual budget by simply underspending it and through gifts, gift income that comes in. And our desire is to continue to offer our services for free. We are rather tight at the moment, actually a staff person down, hoping to raise sufficient funds to get us back up to where we need to be. But we do have a donation box, and we do have brochures. One is able to become a friend of the Wade Center. by a gift. We don't designate how much the gift has to be. Anything helps. That's actually online. You can go to our website and there, click on Friends of the Wade Center. So if anyone listening has a desire to help us out, we would be more than grateful.
And again, the web address, you could of course just look for the Wade Center, W-A-D-E, on your search engine, but the web address is...
It would be www.wheaton.edu/learnres. It's learn, R-E-S, slash Wade. At least that's what I see here. Though this may be out of date. We have a new... But if you Googled Wade Center,
you'll find
it.
Yeah,
to us.
No problem.
And you could actually access this through Wheaton College's website as well.
As well. Okay. We're talking with the director of the Wade Center, which has a collection of 7 writers in English: Clyde, George MacDonald, Owen Barfield, Dorothy L. Sayers, J.R.R. Tolkien, Chesterton, George MacDonald, and I'm missing one.
Charles Williams,
yes. And we're talking today particularly about the C.S. Lewis collection because Lewis continues to be read so much around the world, with the director of the Wade Center, Professor... my page keeps turning. And Professor Christopher Mitchell has graciously given us the hour of his time on Sunday to talk about the collection. Let's talk about one of the difficult issues in Lewis scholarship, and that's the whole issue of who controls the material and is allowed to publish it, and in what conditions. There's been controversy among Lewis people who read Lewis ever since Lewis's death, because a man named Walter Hooper, an American who had met Lewis for the first time the summer of 63, ended up with largely control over this material and has been the editor for most of the books published since 63. Some people have questioned his abilities and even his honesty. Can you talk about that, or can you not?
I think I could clear up some things. I don't think Walter Hooper had the kind of control that a lot of people assume. Owen Barfield was certainly involved. They brought Walter in a little bit later, and Walter has not been in a position of control for quite some time. The estate established, and he became an employee of the state, and works for them as an employer. He's now retired, has been for quite some time.
Is he in his 80s now?
Yes, he just turned 80.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of controversy. Well, there was, especially in the 70s, 80s, a lot of controversy swirling around his editorial abilities, but I think most of that has all been sorted out with regard to the editing. He's really done quite a fantastic job of that, a lot of work. A lot of the controversy came around the Dark Tower manuscript, accusations that it was a fraud and that some even accused him of forgery. All I can say with regard to that is I've seen the manuscript and I have no question that it's Lewis. I think one of the reasons he didn't finish it is that it really wasn't going anywhere, wasn't very good. Now, everybody has this assumption that anything Lewis did was really, really good, and I think that's to ask too much of anybody.
Lewis might not have preferred to have it published, however.
right. There are other things, fragments that weren't published. But Walter, as he began, was incredibly enthusiastic and worked hard. And yes, there were tensions and things, I think, early on in areas. But with regard to the editorial part of his work, I think he's certainly above board. And he's become a friend. He's a friend of the Wade Center. We work with him, cooperate with him. In fact, we granted him a Clytus Kilby Lifetime Achievement Award just a few years back for his recognition of the work that he's done.
He was a graduate student at the time he met Lewis. He later became Anglican clergy, a chaplain, mm-hmm. and then converted to Roman Catholicism.
Right. He's been with the Roman Church for quite a while now.
Right. Mm-hmm. He was not a scholar, and some of us who've read the original materials of Lewis and then seen how Hooper published them wish that he were, because there aren't footnotes that indicate omissions or changes, and mm-hmm. that makes it difficult. But,
he made certain decisions, especially in the poetry, because there were a number of different versions. And Don King from Moncrief College has done a nice piece of work on Lewis's poetry, and if one wants to read that, they'll have his judgment, a very educated judgment, as to Walter's editorial work. And generally, Don King feels it was positive. He may take exception, but I think anybody working with Lewis's poetry may have favored one version over another.
Sure.
Michael Ward, another scholar from Oxford now, also, I think, would generally agree that Walter's work was good. So some of that controversy has died down over about the last 10 years, I think it's all for the better now. People are more focusing in on Lewis himself and what he did, and I'll tell you, there wouldn't be nearly as much available if it wasn't for Walter's work and efforts over the years.
Let me give the phone numbers again. We're down to our last 7 or 8 minutes, but we can fit in a call or two, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, long distance, 800-222-9455. We're talking with the director of the Wade Center about the materials there by the author C.S. Lewis. Lewis wrote so many things. Before his death in 63, I think I remember over 50 books had been published. If you sort of take away duplicate titles and different editions and so forth. But Lewis one time commented in a letter that he thought he was proudest of maybe his space fiction book, Perlandra, and maybe the novel he wrote, Till We Have Faces, telling an ancient myth in modern dress.
Mm-hmm.
As you have looked at all of his materials, let's talk about those at least written before his death, or published right after his death. What stands out in your mind if you were introducing Lewis to someone who had never read him?
First comment would be, you're right, he thought Perelandra was one of the finer things he wrote fictionally, and at the end, Till We Have Faces, he thought was his best. I think when people think of C.S. Lewis, they think Screwtape Letters, they think of Mere Christianity, and they think of the Chronicles of Narnia, and that especially because of the movies that have come out. So those would be the front and center pieces, but as one begins to read, they discover so much more. And he wrote both fiction and nonfiction. And I would say for the audience here as well that the central thing Lewis was hoping to do in much of his writing was to create a space, and that space is both intellectual and imaginative, in which the Christian faith becomes plausible. He didn't see himself as a person that calls people to Jesus, an evangelist, but what he felt he could do is create these sort of intellectual, imaginative spaces in which the faith becomes plausible and one can think about it with a greater sense of objectivity.
Of all the books Lewis wrote, what are some of the ones that you wish people knew more about?
Excellent question. The Great Divorce, with regard to his fiction, I think is just wonderful. It's
An unfortunate title. An unfortunate title. Yes.
Yeah. It's basically about a group of citizens from hell who take a trip, a bus trip up to heaven to check it out, and they're in meet people that they knew and during their lives on Earth, and these people try to talk them into not going back to hell and staying. And those encounters, that's basically the book is about those encounters. And it's well worth looking at. Till We Have Faces, I don't think many people have read that. It's, again, one of his finest pieces of work. I personally like the space trilogy.
I do too.
The Out of the Silent Planet, Paralandra, and That Hideous Strength.
I often tell people at large state universities they must read That Hideous Strength because it's set there. And,
right.
And Lewis, in another place, in one of his later prefaces to the Screwtape Letters, says, hell is where everyone is perpetually concerned about their own reputation and advancement. Or I may not have it exactly right, and I often think of big universities as that kind of hell.
Yeah, another way of looking at what he does in The Great Divorce in his book, which I'd also encourage people, if they'd like to get at the heart of Lewis's journey from his home in Belfast to Christianity, he has an autobiography entitled Surprised by Joy. It's a wonderful read, and one of the epitaphs in one of the latter chapters is from George MacDonald. Is the one principle of hell is I am my own. And The Great Divorce in many ways is playing out that theme. So Surprised by Joy would be another one. People who do not know about his literary work, his work on literary criticism, literary history, and that there's some wonderful pieces, The Discarded Image, Experiment and Criticism. Those would be the two I would encourage them to start.
Or Preface to Paradise Lost.
Preface to Paradise Lost would be another one.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote in many different ways. And there is a wonderful collection, too, of essays called God in the Dock. If one wants to just take sort of more bite-sized pieces of Lewis's thinking on a variety of topics and issues, that collection, God in the Dock, would be the one I would encourage them to pick up.
And one that I often encourage people to read, particularly, and again, in university communities, is a series of three lectures that he gave, and it's published as The Abolition of Man, again, an unfortunate title in terms of drawing people in. But it gets at some very interesting educational and moral issues.
Mm-hmm. In fact, it's probably the most prophetic there. He actually, in 1943, as early as 1943, is beginning to see the seeds of what we know now as postmodernism, sort of movement from objective to value to subjectivism. And as you say, just three, well, it was three lectures given up at Durham University that were put together in a book.
It's only 60 pages or so, but quite provocative reading.
And challenging.
It is challenging. It's
yes.
It's not C.S. Lewis at his easiest, but it's worth the effort often, I think.
I would agree.
Okay. We're down to our last couple minutes, Chris, and I want to thank you for spending this time with us talking about the Wade Center in Wheatson. And as I remember, you even have parking there for visitors.
Oh, we do, just across the street behind what's called Edmund Chapel, and there's signs there that designate it.
It's difficult to imagine visiting a college or university and having free parking, but but thank you for that. Tell us about the building itself. It's a very, very pleasant place, but tell people what they will see as they walk toward it.
Well, it's styled, the history, just September 2001, we opened our doors to our own freestanding building. We were housed in the old part of the library on campus prior to that. And this building is the result of the family of Wade, Mary Wade in particular. And it's styled after an old English manor home, so stone and brick, with a garden in the front that kind of mimics a quad, Oxford quad, along with an English rambling garden style around it. It's spacious. It's really a lovely space. And the reading room has both seating for, you know, at a table doing research. We have, or reading, we have hookups for laptops. But we also have a bay window with some more comfortable seating to just sit down and read. So people continue to come back now, not simply for the collections, but they really enjoy the space as well. It'd be a wonderful place to spend an afternoon.
We are out of time, and want to thank our guest, Professor Christopher Mitchell from Wheaton College, who is the the director of the Wade Center. Focuses on seven Christian authors. We've been talking today particularly about the collection of C.S. Lewis. Thank you again, Chris, for being on the program. And again, I remind listeners, if you missed part of this, you may go to our archive. In about a week, this will be easily available free at will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Next week, I'll be the guest, along with Don Nolan. We'll be being interviewed by Professor Stan Yanchus from Parkland College about keeping the faith. Next week, the week following, March 11, we'll be back to our regular type of program, and we'll be talking about world hunger and the Church World Service. On March 18, we'll be talking with the guest we tried to get last week and were not able to, Jay Michelson, about his book, God Versus Gay, The Religious Case for Gay Rights. On March 25th, we'll be talking about Kenya, Safe Zones in Kenya, with Professor Esther Portnoy and others. Jackie Lynn will be talking about the Episcopal Peace Foundation on the 1st of April. And I mentioned that Axel Gehrman will be talking, who had spoken at the Y at a Friday forum on the Wall Street confrontations. We'll be talking about that, and that'll be April 29. April 22 will be Roger Ebert, and that'll be an archive program, him talking about, back in 1999, religious themes in films. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
This fall, visit England and Wales, locations made famous in Last of the Summer Wine, Downton Abbey, and more, including Agatha Christie's home on the coast of South Devon. Does American history suit you? Well, travel in private vintage train cars on our Civil War train. This September's itinerary includes important southern battlefields and discussions with historian Anthony Pitch. Information is at will.illinois.edu/willtravel or call 217-333-7300.
This is Illinois Public Media.